So good morning, everybody. My name is Rob Phillips, and I want to be the first to welcome you to the course of cellular evolution. And let me introduce Hernan Garcia. So he's the co-organizer of the course, and then Mike Lynch right there, and Shelley Sazer back there. So they're the program coordinators for the program that's going on concomitantly, and we'll say more about that as we go along. So Hernan and I are just going to give you about 20 minutes of introduction to what we're up to and what this course is all about, and then we're gonna go through your lightning talks. Okay, so all of you students and also the TAs have sent lightning talks along. So I just wanted to say that that this notion of evolutionary cell biology is in its infancy, I think. And what I mean by that is that there's a lot of interest these days. So at the bottom you see this article that both Mike and Shelley were part of that was a position piece in PNAS, which you might find interesting to look at. And then earlier this year at HHMI, there was actually a meeting on evolutionary cell biology. And there's a bit of a buzz about it. And actually, at 10:30 today, we're going to hear from Mike with his own views of what that means. And tomorrow, Shelley will give us her views. And so I'm not going to touch that any further, because I think that the course itself will speak for itself. Just a comment, probably many of you have heard this line, but I doubt that many of you have read this famous article, and it's really a very interesting article. I highly recommend that you take a look at it. And there's been a statement in recent years that nothing in evolution makes sense except in the light of cell biology, which I think is also an interesting spin on that, and that's the kind of thing that will be explored here. So just a quick word. So there's two things going on here, and I have a feeling that for many people it's a little confusing what their relationship is to each other. So let me just try to quickly say, first of all, there's a program, and the KITP has three programs going on concurrently. There's one on lattice QCD, I think, and then there's one on spin orbit coupling, and then there's our program. And what that means is that there's on the order of 20 physicists and biologists here for between 3 months and sort of minimum is about 2 weeks. And they have offices in this building, and that you will see the participants in the program, because they'll be joining us for talks. And we're also going to invite them over to the course in the evenings. So we're going to have people come over and have some panels and try to generate a little heat between the people that are here just for the fun of it. Then we also are going to have this our course, which is what we're getting started right now. And this is a 5 week long course, and again, that's going to be somewhat self-explanatory. So in the program, as I already said, Mike and Shelley and I are the program coordinators, and there's going to be on the order of 70 participants during the next 2.5 months. And the course has 18 students. And then there's four so-called affiliates that are more or less, at least several of them, are going to act as though they're students. And then there's 8 faculty members and around 12 TAs that will be passing through, and different people will make themselves known as we go along. And as I said, the program and the course will often share morning lectures. And that's just another chance for me to say that, at least for the course, just so you guys know, we're going to run a very tight ship. And what I mean by that is we have a very systematic schedule, and we're going to start stuff on time. And you'll probably find Hernan and me fairly annoyed if you're not there on time, because if there's protocols and you require us to explain to you something that we've already explained to everyone else, that's rude and it wastes our time. Okay, so really we want you to be on time. That's enough of that. So there's a very long history of intensive experimental summer courses. So some of the most famous work that was done in the early days of molecular biology was done at Cold Spring Harbor, where, for example, Lurie and Delbruck did their famous experiment, which we are going to do ourselves today. And so you guys will be doing exactly this, which is looking at little petri dishes. And then the physiology course and the embryology course and many others at the Green Biological Laboratory is another one example. That's a 120-year-old course. They're usually on the order of 2 months long, very intensive atmosphere. And so those are kind of some historical things. And Boris, who just walked in and is sitting back there, and actually somebody you should all meet, Boris Schramann, he's a permanent member of the KITP. And he had the idea, which is very unusual for the KITP. Note the name of this place, Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics. So it's kind of odd to have experimental courses here. and it's also, in my opinion, great. And
within the cell at the organelle level is that damaged DNA, mitochondrial DNA, makes it, these membranes with the damaged DNA deficient in participating in this fusion process, and this increases the probability of that damaged DNA being removed through mitophagy. And ultimately, we'd like to integrate this understanding with all of the different selection mechanisms acting at the population level.
Hi, I'm Sanita. I'm a postdoc in NCBS, Bangalore. I have been working with bacteria for a while now, looking at the genetic strategies that they use to survive under stress conditions. So currently I'm working on evolutionary remodeling of global regulatory networks. I work with E. coli, and the system I use is a prolonged stationary phase in Luvia vaginae medium, data has shown that a lot of mutations accumulate during stationary phase adaptation, and they call it as a GASC phenomenon because it gives them a growth advantage in a stationary phase. Now, as a part of genetic strategies, mutations, they could accumulate in regulators or in structural genes, and data shows that mostly regulators accumulate mutations because it has a wider reach and easy and faster to attain. So I'm interested in regulators. So these regulators, and another interesting point that appears about regulators is that these regulators still retain some functions. So it's not completely loss of mutations. And these are frequent mutations. So this gives us an opportunity to look at further evolution in a bacterial cells once it gets a regulator, which is still partially functional. So what I'm looking at now is how a partially functional regulator would give this advantage to the cells. So change in gene expression, whether it's like a generic reduction in gene expression or there are specific functional modules that are affected, that could be because of its interaction with other partners. In addition to that, I'm also looking at how it's evolving over a period of time and so these, I'm also looking at the evolution of these regulators in further. What other mutations will accumulate over a period of time? Whether these will be regulators, more regulators, or strategies.
Okay, we're missing two. Somehow they're not showing up.
Sorry.
All right. We'll see. Where is not.
Thomas, if I were to draw the house where I grew up, I'd probably draw something like this. It's a big farm in the middle of the Netherlands. We had some horses and things like that. If I were to draw myself, I'd probably draw myself reading in a park in Enschede where I did my chemical engineering degree. Or I'd draw myself reading in Parc Ciutadella in Barcelona where I did my PhD on near-field scanning optical microscopy. It's basically the first true super resolution technique. And if I were to draw a cell, I probably everybody would draw something like this, right? So the thing that all these guys have in common is that they all outline the object from the outside. And in the case of a cell, it's actually the cell membrane. It's the cell membrane that demarcates, that interfaces between the environment and the cell itself. It's a place where actually all communication from the cell towards the environment, from the environment towards the cell, needs to go through. So that's essentially what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the spatial-temporal fluctuations of chemistry on this membrane. And I'm trying to use different, mostly optical techniques to try and figure this out. And I'm here to figure out what is the evolutionary kind of angle to the organism.
Cool. And did you drop it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Hi, I'm Lydia. I'm one of the TAs. I've been working with molecular genetics and cell biology for about 15 years, but the questions I ask keep ending up being evolutionary. So for my postdoc, I ended up in the Lynch Lab, and it's been great. Here are some of the questions that I'm looking at right now. One, how do duplicate genes play, how does the evolution play out at the subcellular level? So I'm doing that by looking at localization of RAB GTPases, which are members of a large gene family, and when they change function, their localization changes. So I do a lot of biology stuff, and I also do a lot of cell biology with a microscope. More recently, I'm also interested in uncovering the syntax of transcription factor binding sites in paramecium species. So we're doing something like this mouse tail vein assay where they injected a whole bunch of constructs and see the readout in mice. But we can do this with paramecium because we can just inject into the macronucleus. So we're working on doing that. And lastly, I've always been interested in how membrane trafficking pathways are hijacked by intracellular pathogens, which kind of plays into my first interest in RABs. So I'm really looking forward to working with all you guys, and I'm looking forward to learning a lot about quantitative biology this week.
Hi everyone, my name is Michael Manhart. I'm a postdoc in the Department of Chemistry at Harvard, where I worked at Eugene Shekinovich, and before that I did my physics PhD at Rutgers. So I guess my interests kind of span broadly at the interfaces of systems biology, molecular biophysics, and statistical physics. And so that covers a lot of different things, but sort of a unifying theme for most of that is evolution. And so, particularly starting in grad school, I've been really interested in understanding molecular mechanisms of evolution. And so one example of this is to understand the coevolution of, say, protein folding and protein binding. And so you might draw a little cartoon of the fitness landscape. This is a function of both its the protein folding stability and its binding energy with some other molecule. And you can try to understand something about the evolutionary dynamics of proteins through such a model. And sort of on the other side of that is to understand sort of more general theoretical questions about the structure of fitness landscapes and how they affect evolutionary trajectories. So I've worked on that a fair bit, especially more in grad school. More recently, especially, I've been really interested in understanding and thinking about experimental evolution of microbes, in particular using that to sort of investigate very quantitatively or very directly some of the theoretical questions from evolution that I've worked on. And so, for instance, one of the projects I did since grad school was working with these experimentalists who had inserted a synthetic gene regulatory module into yeast that had this nice positive feedback behavior that was really interesting, and that responded to an environmental inducer and to an antibiotic stress. And then we evolved this over several weeks in the lab in yeast, and we could see how the dynamics of different kinds of mutations arose. And finally, I also am very interested in random walks in physics and biology.
Hi, everybody. My name is Niranjan Srinivas, and I'm just starting as a postdoc in Hernan Garcia's lab at UC Berkeley. So for my PhD, I was really interested in questions of how networks of chemical reactions can do information processing and patterning and things like that. So I focused on engineering them in a completely synthetic way in a test tube with just DNA molecules and nothing else. So things like this oscillator I showed here. For my postdoc, I'm excited to study how this kind of chemical magic happens in an embryo. So how you get patterns of crazy complexity and how this happens. I've not done biology before, so I'm super excited to start and just look at everything. And I'm going to be like a kid in a candy shop in this course. So thanks.
Actual result. As I use the black hole, that's a good in the Swiss.
Okay, so my name is Jean-Daniel, but you can just call me JD, it's fine. I come from Lyon, France, and I am a PhD student working on the coupling between the biochemistry and mechanics in plant morphogenesis. So why do we do that? Well, the mechanics of morphogenesis is quite a new topic, and it has been, forgotten with the rise of biochemistry, and now we try to combine the two fields. So I use computational modeling to study things such as the mechanics of cell divisions, mechanics and growth, or some patterning mechanisms, combining the two fields. And I am also the wiki guy, so if you have a problem with that, you can let me know. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chico. I'm working at the University of Oxford, and I would like you to imagine something. Imagine this row is full of dice on the floor, along them, and I give you 10 seconds to get the biggest number you see. Well, you give me 6.
Fair enough.
But what if these dice are loaded? What if for some reason the number 4 is more frequent than any other one? Well, in that limited amount of time, you'll say, oh, the biggest one you have is a 4.
Cool.
Now, you see that this biased variation, it's affecting the outcome of the selection you're making. Imagine that you're Mother Nature then, and you've got gene networks instead of dice, and you're looking for one that does its job, that it has the best cell cycle or something. What if I told you that's how nature works? That it's looking for many gene networks, but some of them, actually a lot of them, give you the same phenotypes, some phenotypes more frequently than others. And that has nothing to do with fitness in principle. That's essentially what I'm looking for. I'm trying to hunt for these gene networks, and more than that, trying to understand how nature hunts for them. I'm in the second year of my PhD, and it's been a lot of fun. That's it. Cool.
Hello, everybody. I'm Ramna. I'm a graduate student with Mukul, and I'm from National, NCNAS from Bangalore, India. And the question I'm trying to address is the role of gene duplication in the evolution of eukaryotes. We can look at it from different levels. So if we look at it in the context of a single protein family, that is rhizomes, so we saw how the duplication of the gene dynamin is related to the other mechanisms. So basically, dynamin is involved in the division of endosymbionts as well as clathrin-mediated endocytosis, and we found out how it plays, the duplication of the gene plays a role with respect to this. Right now, what I'm working on is hybridization. So when two species hybridize, not only is there a doubling of the whole of the genome component, but since the two species have diverged for a very long time, there is a diversification. So we think that that is a very fertile place to look for new compartments. And since I don't have time to go into the details per se, I will just leave you with the teaser. This is the EM images of the three species. These are the two parent species, and you can look at their alpha structure, which is much less crowded as compared to the hybrid, which is much more dense at the level of intracellular. So maybe we are looking at a parent place.
Sorry, Ryan.
No worries. I can't follow directions. So I'm Ryan. I'm from Nipal Patel's lab at UC Berkeley. And I have the slightly humbling project of trying to link populations with photonics. And we're doing this largely through butterflies, not exactly these butterflies, which would be illegal to work on, but they demonstrate quite nicely the idea, which is hidden behind this figure. So basically what you find is in these butterflies, males here are shown on the right, females are shown on the left. They exist on slightly different islands, and the males will have different colors on different islands. So there's some, it looks like, at least because there's differences in male and female, there's probably some sexual selection, but also probably drift has occurred. That's an interesting thought to think about anyway. It's giving rise to these different colors. But what's cool is that these different colors actually are not pigmentary. There's no pigments here involved in making these colors, but instead, if we were to zoom in really close on, say, this orange one and that green one down there, it's been shown by another group that the color is actually coming from these small unicellular projections coming out of the wing epithelium that are called scales. And these are dead, formed in the adult. But what you'll find is that these scales actually are of different colors, orange or green. And if you were to do a section and then look in electron microscopy, what you find is if you do some intense measuring, there's actually differences in spatial dynamics between like these various ridges and then even the internal side of the scale that's actually giving rise to these colors, almost like a soap film on water or a prism in effect. What we've been finding is that in other butterflies that we're actually studying, so this one is green, it's a section like these, this one's blue, there's actually some shape morphogenesis differences, and this seems to be linked to actin patterns. So again, this is a single cell, the actin surface is actually hexagonal in this case. And this one, it's actually more rectangular. And it looks like it actually starts here and goes up.
Aha, that's me. I'm Stephanie Barnes. I grew up and went to school at the undergrad in Boise, Idaho, which is not in the Midwest, contrary to popular belief. Now I'm at Caltech in Rob's group. And there's this really annoying problem if you're interested in transcriptional regulation, and that is that for the majority of genes, there is just like no information available as to how they're transcriptionally regulated. No transcription factors, no transcription binding sites, nothing. And this is true even in really well-studied organisms like E. coli. So what we're trying to do is figure out an easy way to figure out how a gene is transcriptionally regulated. I'm going to tell you exactly how to find binding sites in 30 seconds. You start with a promoter of interest. You put it next to a GFP so that it's driving the GFP. And you introduce mutations so that you end up having a big library of E. coli that all have a slightly different mutant. So what that does is gives you a nice broad distribution of fluorescence, and you can put it through a cell sorter and sort cells out based on their fluorescence level. And then you can sequence the contents of these sorted bins. And then you put it through the black box of computation that I can't go into right now, and you end up getting this cool map of binding sites. And what we've done is we've basically looked at each binding site and seen which mutation, or sorry, each base pair and seen which mutations have the biggest effect on expression. And so then you end up with this cool map. It shows you where the RNAP binding site is, so that's a good sign that our promoter has a polymerase. But it also shows is where you might be able to find transcription factor binding sites. And something that I'd be interested in doing, which is part of the reason that I'm at this evolution course, is to compare promoters.
Sorry.
Oh no! Yeah. I thought 90 seconds was longer!
Should have practiced.
Hi, I'm Li Houjie from Townhouse Lab at Peking University. You can call me Houjie or call me Li. The question I'm interested in is what are the evolutionary advantages of the coordination between cell growth and the cell proliferation. Because we all know that this coordination will change with the environment, and we know that in genetics, this coordination is carefully controlled and highly conserved, but we don't know why. We don't know what's the benefit, is it? And also, to address this question, we use cell size distribution as a proxy of this coordination, and we built a parameter-free model to and predicts the size and the cell growth rate relationships. And we use a continuous culture system, Turbidity Stats, to test these predictions under different environment and drugs and genetic interference.
Hi everyone, my name is Shan Tanqi. I'm also from Peking University. I'm now in a cognitive biology physics program. My background is also physics. So one of my present project is to study the correlation of gene expression noise during cell-phase transitions. Why I'm using this question is because cell-phase transition is very ubiquitous and important life phenomena. But often we don't know the exact replicate network underlying this process. So I study it from a dynamic system point of view. So the basic idea is that each cell phase can be represented as a high dimensional attractors. So what's important is how many attractors are there and the topological relationship between these attractors. So the cell phase transition can be represented as the qualitative change of these landscapes. So at this critical transition point, we might see some critical signatures, such as the divergence of this gene expression noise, or there might be some strong anti-correlation or correlation between some of the genes. So we combine mathematical models and the theoretical analysis with cognitive experiment to answer these questions. Okay.
Hi everyone. My name is Jorge Tenido. I'm at Penn State University, and you may notice I have an accent, so I'm originally from Mexico, so that's where I did my undergrad in physics. And this picture kind of summarizes all my PhD work. So I'm in my fifth year, hopefully last year of my PhD. And the general thing we're interested in is we go with biologists, and they have like certain processes they think they have the signal transduction gene regulatory network that controls that process. So we're okay. We want to construct a network based on what they tell you, kind of up with that network, put some dynamics under it, try to see if we can reproduce what they know should reproduce, and then ask, okay, can I actually make new predictions for you so you can try, for example, in a certain kind of cancer, how can you predict certain kind of transitions? So this actual network is the one involved in the epithelium essential transition in liver cancer. So basically we did this with some cancer biologists. And part of what I do is basically make sure that this model makes sense according to what the biologists say it should do and what the max says actually makes sense. And also create these new methods to be able to analyze this. Because this, what we do is a kind of modeling in which instead of using these continuous variables, we use a discrete number of variables. So basically that allows us to do analysis of networks of this size that would be impossible with traditional differential equation methods. So I'm really excited to be here because being from physics, I never had the opportunity at all to do any kind of experiments, and I always wanted to do it. So this will hopefully give me the opportunity. And I guess I also want to thank my advisor. She let me go away for one. She let these tears go away for 1 month just to do experiments.
Okay. My name is Tom. And I just want to share the story of some of the important decisions I made ever since graduating college. So I came into grad school not having any idea what I wanted to do or who I wanted to work for, but I knew that I wanted to do physics. And in my mind, you could either do experiments or you can do theory. So I was with the test takers over here, and theory was really three types of options. You can either just work on equations all day, or you can do hardcore programming, where you make a giant program for 2 years, and then you spend 2 years running it and getting data. Or you can do something in the middle, where you look at interesting phenomenon, but they're minimal to very simple mathematical formulation. So that's really what I'm shooting for, and hopefully everybody can recognize this as a beautiful mathematical plot, which I super love. So after deciding what I wanted to do, I was fortunate enough to get transferred into biology whenever I listened to Rob Phillips brainwash me for 2 hours. I was sold, and it was fortunate because he actually follows this exact same path as well, so I didn't have to redo the whole cycle myself. And that's where I am today. I'm more on the theoretical side, but I'm hoping to be kind of a theoretical experimentalist after a KITP. And currently I study phenomena that are just weird and bizarre. So like a curve that shouldn't have a peak in it has a peak in it. Why does it happen? How does it happen? Give some math. Cool.
Hi everyone, my name is Stephanie Jonas. I'm in the lab of Stephen Flake at Stanford University. I'm a PhD student. I'm just entering my second year, so getting started with things. And I'm a member of the Department of Bioengineering. Prior to that, I did my undergrad at Rice. And I actually focused on biomaterials and tissue engineering in the lab of Antonios Mikos, with a particular interest in bone regeneration. So as you might imagine, I'm really interested in the ties between development and regeneration, and really interested in what drives cell differentiation. So I'm looking forward to exploring cell evolution with all of you in the upcoming
thanks. So there's a few people missing. We didn't get your slides, so I don't know if you feel like standing up. Go for it.
I think I sent the slide.
I was pretty careful, but maybe you did. I didn't. I don't
know. My own computer if you want.
What?
You can use my own computer.
You can. Go for it. Do you have a slide?
Yeah, I have a slide. I was just saying goodbye.
Okay. Well, okay, so while they're trying to get their act together, so we're done with this. We're done with this part after they go. And I just invite you guys to imagine a day 5 weeks from now when you're going to give your exit lightning talks. Because it's going to be so bizarrely different. You're just going to have a hard time imagining it right now. It's going to be very interesting. So, it's Phoebe, right?
Yeah.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Go for it. They don't have any questions, just not for the speakers, but just the goal questions or anything. Okay. Boris, do you want to say anything?
Hello.
Right. Aaron will tell you when you're ready, or I'll signal to you. It's time to start.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Phoebe, and I'm originally from Taiwan, and currently I'm a graduate student in the Andrew Mullins Lab at Harvard. And the questions I really want to address during my PhD is I want to know how the function of a clathrin protein can specialize for mitosis and meiosis. Let me give you a little bit intro about what this protein does. So clathrin protein is a subunit of the colchicine complex. And colchicine complex is a multi-protein complex, and it is very important to hold the sister chromatids together, and it can determine when and where and how the chromosome segregates. And interestingly, like in most of eukaryotes people have studied so far, we noticed that in mitosis, eukaryotes will use a specific copy of colchicine. However, in meiosis, the cells will use another copy of colchicine. So my question is, I want to know why the cell needs to use two different copies of proteins for two different cellular divisions. And we think if we will be able to understand the map between the clathrin protein sequence and the clathrin protein function, maybe we can get some magnetic insight about how the evolution of complexity can come from. So by using budding yeast as a model system, first I want to identify if there is any like sequence determinants for the mitotic or meiotic function of this protein. And secondly, I'm also going to use the experimental evolution approach to address what kind of mutations can influence the evolutionary trajectories of changing a clathrin protein into the other. For example, I'm going to set up an evolution experiment to take the meiotic copy and put into the mitotic complex and see how this protein can perform the mitotic function and track the evolutionary intermediate protein.
Okay.
Yes.
Shingo, you want to go?
Hello everybody, my name is Xinguo Yang. I have recently completed my PhD in Syracuse University with Dr. Christian Marchetti, my advisor, and I will be going to Northwestern University to start my postdoc with Dr. Mada Hatmani and David Schwab. So I think I come from a slightly different background. During my PhD, I'm studying the collective phenomena in active systems using computer simulations and condensed matter theories. So the questions I'm trying to answer is basically how do active systems here defined as systems composed of self-driven units that are able to convert ambient-free energy into systematic motion, how do those systems collectively generate dynamical and mechanical patterns? So they are really out of equilibrium systems that can find realizations in biological systems and artificial systems over a large spectrum of length scales. So I've studied the mechanics and self-assembly of self-propelled particles using computer simulations, and also pattern formation in active systems using condensed matter physics theories, from the dynamics of actual mouse networks to natural bird flocks. And recently, I'm looking at the mechanics of confluent tissue, specifically the collective cell migration, and focusing on the glassy dynamics as well as the stress generation in those systems. So I'm a complete green hand for evolutionary biology, but that's why I come to this course. So any help would be appreciated. Thank you.
All right, great. So let's thank everyone. I guess the thing I would say is it should be pretty clear from hearing the talks that all of you are experts in certain areas and then maybe have very little experience in others. So, you know, you mentioned you haven't pipetted before. So that's going to be great. This afternoon, you will definitely have your chance. And for those of you that don't write MATLAB code all the time and haven't segmented images, you know, you'll have a crack at that tonight. And this is really why this notion of suspending disbelief is important. So what Arnon already said, but I'm going to say it again, which is just keep an open mind. We're here to have fun and learn stuff. And yes, you might be an expert, like I'm thinking of Michael over there, you know, like he probably uses some computation stuff every day of his life. Maybe you can help people out when we're doing image analysis. You know, there's a few of you. And then those of you that know how to pipette, maybe you can help out the people that have the green hands, you know. So it's, I don't know, my version of this is I'm reasonably good at doing calculations, but every time I have to do a tenfold dilution, I sit there and I go, okay, the total number of molecules is C times V. I want to have a tenfold less, and then I figure that out, and I, after a bunch of nonsense, I'll finally figure it out, whereas others can just... So, do you have anything else you want to say? So, this is for the students. You guys were totally open to getting feedback every day. Basically, one day here is a week at home. I know you think I'm kidding, but I'm not kidding. We're going to be, you know, pedal to the metal all the time. And if you have something you want to see changed, or if you have an opinion or whatever, come and talk to Arnon and me, and we'll do our best to do something about it. Greg and Boris are also around. Mike and Shelley will be available for you if you have thoughts about how we can interact with the program. But even already starting tomorrow night, I'm going to try and get several people that are in the program to come over to the lab and give us their thoughts for a half hour, maybe over refreshments, about what evolutionary cell biology means to them, because we will have heard from Mike and Shelley by that time. And maybe we'll have a debate around that. We might also do some things that you guys will find interesting, like having young PIs come over. Like I think I'll invite Irene Chen and a couple of Arnon, Rob Brewster, and have them give a little panel for you about, you know, what it means to be a young PI. I think that's my experience is people have very much enjoyed that. So we're open to that. We can have debates, whatever. So this is a dynamical object. It will evolve. We're going to be chill. We're going to have fun. And that's it. I don't know, Greg, Boris, Shelley, Mike, anybody want to say anything?
I'd like to mention the wiki space.
Please.
I think it was mentioned a couple of times, but...
So this is Greg Cooper. He's, I think, like the... I don't know, director of education or something or other. I don't know what
Deputy it's director.
Deputy anyway, director.
There's a wiki space. We use it as a tool to communicate with each other and also to store information. And it also has the most current version of the weekly schedule for your course and program. So everyone should go to it, consult it. Today, I think it's more or less frozen, but even I know tomorrow's schedule is still a little in flux, so you might want to wake up in the morning and the first thing you do is look at the wiki space to see what the story really is, because there's some confusion about when we're going to start tomorrow. So So you can go to www.evocell15.wikispaces.plural.com. And everyone should have received an invitation. I'm not sure everyone did. So if you didn't receive an invite to join the wiki space, send me an email. I'm just huber@kitp.ucsd.edu. Send me an email as soon as possible, and I will send you an invitation to join. I encourage everyone to join the wiki space. You can read the information off of it without joining, but if you want to edit any page, add your personal information, sign up for a social activity, like if you need a ride. Let's say we go to the Channel Islands, there'll be rides to Ventura, that's where the boat leaves, so on. You need to be able to edit, which means you need to join. So everyone should join the wiki space. Okay? Rob, back to you.
Okay, well, so we have, Boris, please.
Well, I'll just, so first, welcome you. And emphasize, Rob already said that this is a dynamic object, and I'm sure, right, an evolving object. And I'm sure Rob and Hernan have a very busy schedule for you, but so the creativity and initiative is a very big part of it.
Yep.
So please don't feel too constrained by the schedule and push and shove, and you know, tell these guys exactly what you think. And you know, nights are long, and if you have some great idea that you want to explore, we have lots of toys there in the lab, and there's a lot of expertise, with TAs and fearless leaders and various other participants in the program, right? So just get something that you're excited about and do it.
Yeah. So I want to follow up on that. That's very important, and I completely agree with Boris. This week is a little different just because it's the boot camp week. We want to make sure that you can run the microscopes, you won't ruin them and crash the objectives into cover slips. And we want, those of you that don't use MATLAB all the time, you know, I'm thinking of Jeff, not trying to put you on the spot, but you know, like, we're going to rough you up.
Yeah.
The bottom line is we want to give you the tools so that you can do what Boris just said. The rotations are very, very sort of relaxed in the sense that you need to find out what you're excited about doing. They're not relaxed in the sense that it's pedal to the metal. You will not get any sleep. So, yeah, but creativity, for sure. So, I think we have a break now until 10:30, at which time we're going to meet in here. Mike Lynch is going to give a talk. And, you know, I'd really encourage, I'm going to start asking questions. Boris will probably do it. But the students, really, you'll get into the KITP thing. So maybe we'll all stand up and do Gangnam style for asking questions. Okay, anyway, so I guess it's, maybe there's something out here for break, or if not, I don't know, but we'll be back in 20 minutes.